Welcome to Trapping Across America, where fur brothers meet every week. But we're still allowed to be men, and we're proud to be from the land of the fur and the home of the brave. Host Clint Locklear for Trapping Across America. We have a great show for you this week. I'm sure you're really going to enjoy it. We've got Earl Thompson from Georgia that's going to be talking about live market for coyotes and coyote trapping in general. He's a southern gentleman that I think everybody's going to get a kick out of listening. He's been around. He's one of those guys you notice knows a lot about everything. And then towards the end of the show, I'm going to cover a little bit about thinking outside the box, just some things that maybe trappers should be thinking about, but don't always do it. But before that time, I'm really getting fired up. Within 48 hours, our first season starts here. It's about to drive me crazy. Temperature's about 30 degrees this morning, and it just feels like I should be out doing something, and I'm holding off instead of going out and just beaver trapping like I usually do before season starts, because it's legal here in Tennessee to get some extra beaver and castor. I'm waiting because of the beaver prices this year, and I'm just going to go ahead and start with the fox snaring and the muskrat trapping. And normally I'd say that this radio show is being shot from the dingy depths of PCG's lure shop, where it smells like castor and you got stains everywhere on the floor from us working. But right now there's metal shavings and everything else on the floor where it's turned into a muskrat float building shop, colony trap building shop, and some experimental traps we're trying on some floating repeating muskrat traps. It's one of those things maybe taking just a whole lot of my brain power away and time and not turn out to be anything. But if it works, that's what it's all about. Let's go ahead and get started, and we'll get started with Earl. Right before we do that, though, I will have a little bit of advice I'd like to give some guys out there. If you're new into trapping, before I continue on, we're going to start having some segments on here done by a beaver trapper off of Wolfer Nation. He's going to start having some segments just geared towards beginning trapping, that if you've got some youngsters or something like that, or you're getting new to it, it's a lot more basic than what we seem to talk about more than anything else. I think it was his idea, and I think it's a great thing for him to help us put that together. But if you're new to trapping, or you're been in trapping for a few years, are you just what I want to consider the confused? And I don't mean that in a negative way. Everybody goes through kind of the same steps when they first get into trapping. You get real excited. You get your hands on every book, magazine, you go to the demos, you're getting the videos, you're getting everything. And what happens, the same thing happens at our Texas Predator School, you start getting brain overload and it starts getting confusing. Especially if you're new into trapping and you're reading 20 different ways to do a dirt hole set, 20 different ways to do a flat set. You're hearing umpteen different ways about line management and what type of lure and what type of the year you need to be doing what. It just gets really, really confusing. Now, my advice to anybody in that situation, personally, and this is what I tell a lot of people on the phone or during PMs back on Wolfer Nation, is I tell them, you know, pick who, go with your gut. Whoever seems to get along with the way that you think or the way that appeals to you and their style of trapping, whoever that be, because, I mean, there's aggressive guys that trap, there's very technical guys, there's fun guys, there's guys that are wide open. Everybody's kind of got their own style and their own way of doing things. But whatever that style is that seems to appeal to you, pick two or three guys that you seem to believe in and study what they do. Study what they've written. Study if they've got videos, if they've got any books out. If you've seen them at a convention, you know, just tell them you enjoy what they're doing. And if you got a few questions, ask them. The reason I say to do that is if you pick two or three different guys that you can that you can kind of study and emulate as you get everything together, you're probably not going to have 50,000 different ideas going through your head. You know, me personally, when I first got started, you know, I kind of followed what old Gorman said, and that's the way I went, and I disregarded a lot of other information. Now, by doing that, it got me going down a certain path, and over time, I've definitely deviated from that a lot. But what I found out by doing that, it didn't get me so confused, because, you know, if, and I'm going to throw some names out here, if you're into the coyote trapping and you listen to O'Gorman and John Graham and Slim Peterson and me and Randy Smith and Tim Rose and a lot of these other guys out there, we all do things different. And it's just going to confuse the snot out of you. So pick three or four of them and kind of emulate what they're doing. See what works for you and what doesn't work for you, because everybody's got their own situations. But that's some of the advice that I think with the information age we live in now, where you can get on YouTube and you can do all this other type of stuff. Just pick three or four different guys, kind of listen to them, kind of put them in the same category of what their styles are, and go with it. Now, you can still read and watch videos and do all that, but just because you read something that catches your fancy, just don't run out there and change everything you're doing all at once. Kind of stick, you know, for at least a season or two off of the two or three or four guys that you want to try to emulate. That'll keep the confusion down. That'll get you a right direction. And then the most important thing is listen to your own line and see what's happening on your own line, and you'll get going. Well, I'm going to go and get Earl on here. This is going to be a real treat. A lot of people, you know, he's not very published and stuff like that. Excellent coyote trapper. Jerry Lee got me in touch with him when I was asking for someone that knew the ins and outs of the live market trapping, and I'm really glad I did. So we'll get Earl on here.
When did you start your live market trapping? What got you into that?
Well, I was at the convention in Coleridge, Georgia, state convention in Coleridge, Georgia, and there was a fellow there hunting somebody to catch him some game. And there was one of my buddies that trapped a little bit. He said, "You serious about wanting some game?" He says, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you need to come over here and talk to this fellow." And he brought him over there to me, and that started it right then. And I started trapping them and learning and trying to figure out which traps to use. And I started off with 1.5 Montgomery's putting duct tape on the jaws. And number two Northwood, duct taping the jaws up and catching them in that. Of course, you got to have plenty of power, you know, to hold them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it can be done. And anyway, that's how I started. And then I went to offset trap, offset sleepy creeks. That's a bunch of junk. Don't put that on there. Some folks probably like sleepy creek trap. But anyway, I had a lot of problem with getting cut feet with them offset sleepy creek because they got that ridge on the top, you know.
Right.
But then I wound up with some 175 offset laminated stuff. And then I went from that and I had a few rubber. I bought some rubber jaw when they first come out, and they didn't have those springs on them any good. I dug them things out the pile. You know how you get stuff those back in the pile. I dug them out and reworked them, took all the chain off, put my rig on it, shock spring, everything, and put number 4 music wire springs on them. And hey, they'd hold something, man, you know. And
Were you getting damage though with that strong a spring on the 1.5? I'm sure you're using Victor's at that time.
I'm offset laminated. I use them sleep creek. They're cutting the fool out of them. The 175 Victor's. I put the Dremel on the bottom side of them things. I done this. I done that. I done everything I could think of. And they were some at Bob Young reworked. I mean, you know, it, Bob Young set up with the best base plates and everything on. I still having problems. You know how, I don't care, they don't make a perfect trap. You're gonna get one cove that's just gonna fight like a fool. You're gonna get another that's gonna fight a while, get tired and lay down. Most of the time, his foot won't be hurt. You take him out there, shoot him with a shot of Dex and penicillin. I don't care if they ain't got a mark on the foot. They get a shot of Dex and a shot of penicillin. One thing, it'll make them go to eating quicker. If you get them that penicillin, I think that penicillin gives them an appetite.
Are you shooting them? Are you giving them those shots because of a state law, or just because that's what you think's a better practice?
No. I'm trying to get them by the buyer. That's what I'm doing. I'm trying to get them by the buyer. And we do all kind of things to them. We clip the toenails. We do this. We do that. You know. And some of us wear it. You clip just 2 center toenails off. You know, it's pretty tight there, pretty close to tail off. They won't let it put a be fine and let the pressure off and all that stuff. I don't know about all that. I pretty much don't do that. I just give them a shot of Dex. That Dex is the best thing you can give them because it takes that swelling. It's a steroid, and it takes that swelling out of that foot and keeps it from puffing up. And that's the best thing I found. And if they have got a little mark on them, even with them rubber jaw, that's the main thing I run, rubber jaw. You can't tell me nothing about them because I've been running them. And if I had my choice, I'd run, it could run what I wanted to in the state of Georgia. That's the biggest trap they let us buy with. And if it wasn't for the rubbers, it would be too, the inside jaw spread would be too big.
You're using the number threes now.
I use the number three, but the rubber keeps it to 5 3/4 inch inside jaw spread. That's our limit. But if I've done a bunch of BMP studies. I've done 2 years work for Nova Scotia up there out of Canada, Wildlife Research Center up there, and we get special permits to run bigger traps. And I run last year and year before last, I run some number three vectors, offset laminated. And if I could run that trap, it was the best. Other than a rubber jaw I ever run. I really like that trap. That would be, if it was legal in the state of Georgia, that'd be probably what I'd run it. I was impressed with that trap.
I had such a bad taste in my mouth on rubber jaws for so long. We had a law in Tennessee where you weren't allowed, you had to use them for everything, still do. But at the time, we couldn't modify the trap. We couldn't change springs. We couldn't put a base plate. We couldn't do anything to the trap. Stock chain, everything had to be stock. And there was about a week that I had 3 coyotes pull out in front of me. And every time I see a rubber jaw trap, that flashes in my head and drives me absolutely bonkers.
Oh, yeah. If you can't modify them, you screwed from the get-go. You know what I mean? If you've got them modified, you got to roll where the jaw comes through the frame of the trap. You got to take your channel locks, big channel locks, and bend that up further where they can't snatch the jaws out. You got to base plate it. You got to put your. I always put 2 lengths of chain on my D ring to get the swivel out and monitor the trap to make it bed better. And easier, makes it easier on me. I'm 60 years old. I like easy now. and I put shock springs on them. I do everything that I can do. I do not focal, but I do run music wire number 3s and 4 springs. I like 4s when I can get them. I bought some 3s that they will work, but I like the number 4 springs better. And the reason I don't focal them is on account of catching gray fox. That's too much power on a gray fox, even with a rubber.
Now, are you short chaining those or letting them run a little bit?
Oh, short chain them, yeah. I put 2 lengths of chain, swivel, 2 lengths of chain, shock spring, and a swivel on that. So I got it swiveled up, and in other words, it's the chain, the shock spring's longer than the chain, when you know what I'm saying, that's on the trap.
Mm-hmm.
And you use Fox Hollow Super Stakes. and I put them on chain, because we have ground that you can't drive the stake in but 6 inches deep. And then we got ground you can move three counties over, one county over sometime, or to the other side of the county. And you need 14, 16 inches of chain on the trap because the dang sandy, you need that hole, you know. But we got all types of ground. The reason I use that chain is because it lays down, don't stick up right like a little boy, if you know what. And being your way, you got to find something to pin it down with, you know.
Well, one of
cable if you use cable.
One of the problems I had when I before they changed some of the control laws in Georgia, I used to do a lot more work down there, and when I was in the northern part, you had that red clay, which is just terrible to work in anyway. And before I was smart enough to really bring my own dirt with me, I was trying to use that red clay in the soft catches. To me, always, I mean, a lot of times they would get absolutely locked up, and you throw some frost into that, and it was crazy. How are you getting around that now using them? Or do you think this had extra springs enough to pop it through the dirt?
Well, that stronger spring really, really hits you. But peat moss, you got to put peat moss under the levers where the levers won't stick that red clay.
Okay.
And I throw down a hand of peat moss, bed my trap, and put my pan cover on. And then I put another small handful right on the inside, right around the inside of the trap. And then cover with either skim me off some you know, the sandier dirt or haul dirt with me, or I use a lot of peat moss. That's the way if the rain's on, that stuff is like Play-Doh.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hadn't got something to keep it from, it'll just form, like you said, it'll form a suction to, I don't care if it's rubber jaw or any kind of jaw. I mean, it's terrible when that stuff gets raining on and it turns Play-Doh. I mean, it's awful. But if you hadn't got them heavy duty springs on it, you screwed it from the get go and got it modified. But if you do everything I do, it's an acceptable trap. You know what I'm saying?
Now you're not leaving the peat moss exposed though. You're covering that with some.
Oh, I'm covering it. Yeah, I put about a half inch of dirt on it.
Okay. So that's pretty much
but
what you're running.
But if it's bad enough, I haul in dirt, and then I get dirt, you know, where I can, you know, as I'm trapping. I get a lot of dirt. In Georgia, you know, there's always old barns and stuff around and old shelters, and I'll get dirt out from under them and cover with a, then I'll do my blending material and cover with a little yard grass. And I like to go up here at the church in the fall when it comes a big rain. It'll windrow them old grass clippings.
Mm-hmm.
The water wheel, and I'll rake up them grass clippings and bag them up and tear them with me for to blend with, you know. I like the older ones. You can do it, you know, with your yard grass if you keep working it and working it and working it and working it where it looks old, you know, but that up there always looks old.
That's a good idea there, because normally I just get the grass and put it on my driveway like it's a thing of hay and flip it over 8 or 10 times and put it in the.
Yeah, wet it. You gotta wet it, let it dry, wet it, let it dry to get it the right color, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've done all. You can't name nothing I don't think I probably haven't tried, you know? and then you get to sugar sand. I don't know where you've ever got into sugar sand. Not sugar sand, just as bad as that clay is.
Mm-hmm.
It will settle in and pack like you had packed it with a dang jackhammer around that trap. If you get 3 or 4 inches of rain on it, it will get stiff. And that's what old Slim said. Slim was down in South Georgia around Thomasville. And he got that sugar sand. He says, man, I thought the first time I laid eyes on that dirt, I said, I've died and went to heaven, you know. He said, but you get a big rain. You get a big rag on that stuff, and it'll pack down and settle down. He said, it's just unbelievable how stiff that old sand to get when it gets really soppy wet and it starts to dry out.
Well, I know what you mean. I ran a big otter line out in West Tennessee back when we could road trap. You'd set those conibears in those sugar sand creeks, and we'd get a big flood. It'd take me 40 minutes to get a conibear out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if folks that talk about, you know, folks in Tennessee, I guess that's where I've been. You know, you got a lot of rocky creek bottoms and sandy creek bottoms, and down here we deal in muck, you know, just straight old dang half knee-deep muck, where you got to take your two sticks about big as a inch and a half in diameter, inch and a half is better, and lay them parallel with the stream, and then set your cotter barrel on top of them, keep your cotter barrel from sinking down in that muck, you know.
That sounds like Delta country.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you go, all these streams around here, it's silted in, you know, something terrible with that old muck. It's aggravating. And,
well, you know, a lot of the questions I get, and, you know, one of the main reasons I had you on here is because Jerry Lee recommended you, and since you said that you're the old geezer that still makes his living trapping in a live market and doing predator control, I thought you'd be a good one to ask. Most people hear about the live market, and they hear, you know, they're getting $15, $20 for a coyote if they're lucky, and then they're somewhere out there where someone's paying $75 or $100, and they get all excited about the live market. Why don't you tell us the true story about what the live market has turned into in the last 3 or 4 years?
Well, I'll tell you just what's happened. In October, November, if you can get $75 for them coyotes in places, and then, lo and behold, here comes Christmas time. And every Joe Blow that can catch a coyote has been out catching coyotes and fox. And that $75 about the 10th or the 15th of December turned to 50 or 60. And then about Christmas time, they know they've caught them things up. They want to sell them, you know, to get them some Christmas money. So all of a sudden, you know, they got all they need. We really don't need none, you know. They got two in the damn pen that they ain't killed. But they really don't need none. Now, about all, we'll take them, but we're going to have $40 is all we're going to be able to put in them. And that's exactly what's going on with it. And then, you know, then, well, we're having a hunt next week, and we'll buy some after the hunt, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and you know, when they start that mess, then I go burning up them 22 rifle balls.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, if we trade on something, we've traded. If you ain't, you know, if you ain't worth, you ain't worth your word. If your word ain't no good, you ain't fit to fool with. And that's just exactly what happens. They'll get his folks that's been trapping now for a month. And I know one man that's already caught. He retired, and that's all he does is coyote trap. And he's where there's plenty of coyotes, and he's already caught 50-something coyotes, you know. And he don't set a trap for nothing else. That's all he traps. But he's been out west and got some good instructions and all. And he's a good coyote trapper. But you know, it's and he enjoys catching them, and his goal is to catch 100 every year, and he always catches his 100. One year, I think, caught 148. But, you know, that's enough for about most of these small pens. That's enough for about three pens that one man can supply. Well, all these folks is catching 10 and 20 and 30. You know, they out there, too, and there's 100 of them to every one of the fellas I'm talking about and fellas like me. They just say, well, we're going to take advantage of the situation, and that's what they start doing. We got folks in the state of Georgia snaring coyotes, and they'll brag about they bought 10 from somebody was snared, you know, and didn't have no sore feet and wasn't a fun to think of a mark on them, they'd say, and we got them for $50. We want some more of them snared coyotes. I said, well, you know, I says, how old and useless last night. I said, the first thing they'd do if they found a snare out there, and I worked it, I said, the first thing they'd do is pull my useless license, and I said, I can't afford to do that. I said, but old Joe Blow over yonder, he'll pay that $200 or $300, $400, $500 fine, and he'll go on and keep right on setting snares, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what the markets went to. It, back 15 years ago, I could not get enough fox to catch. I mean, they was just as fast as I could catch them. They was somebody here to get. Every time I'd get 10 or 15 fox, 10 or 15 coyotes, they was somebody here to get them, you know. And now they want them to haul, want you to haul them to them, and you get over there, and they go to finding something hauled in them and all that kind of stuff. And that's where it went. It's kind of went to Hades in a hay basket in the last few years.
Well, the thing that, you know, one of the ploys that I've seemed to notice from talking to guys, it goes to places like, you know, Mississippi was a hot place for a while, Georgia was a hot place for a while, North Carolina seems to be where everybody's going now, and it's eventually going to go to South Carolina or Florida or somewhere. But what the buyers seem to figure out, if you're coming from out of state with the Lacey laws, you can't take the coyote back home with you, so you're pretty much stuck, and you're going to take whatever they give you.
That's right.
And that seems to destroy the local market that way. Not that there's anything wrong with out-of-state trappers doing it, because I've done it a lot of times, but seems like it takes about 4 or 5 years and all the buyers figure that out. And then even if you got a horse trailer full of them, you know, they know you can't take them anywhere.
Yeah, they just saw it come down here from Pennsylvania. And you talk about a horse trailer. He had a horse trailer full. Probably had 30 cows in a horse trailer. And he sold them for a little of nothing because he was ready to go back home. Had to get shit of them, you know what? And they done got, you know, once you pin them for a few days, they get stinking the high hell. You can't hardly stand to skin them. So he dumped them, you know. And then, well, we bought 30 for so-and-so, you know. I don't blame the man. I ain't finding fault in the man. I'm just like you. I'm just stating the fact, you know. And I'd have probably done it, too. You know, it wasn't worth skinning, you know. But let me tell you this while we're talking. Oh, Randy Zerwick, I'm going to call his name because he's world-renowned now. Anyway, him and his little boys, he got his young'uns all trapped with him, and they just exceptional family. And, but he sent off some coyotes, 5 or 6, and I want everybody to know it, that he got $104 for one of his coyote hides.
From Georgia.
So we just telling them now, if when they start that $50 stuff, the majority of us is in the association, so well. You know, last year we had a fella sell a hide for $104. We just skinned the SOBs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go to looking at one another, you know. And I said, yeah. I said, he got top lot on the coyote from Georgia, and I says, got his hat and his little pen and everything. I said, $104 for a coyote hide. I said, you know, I said, we'll just kind of take our chances. And that puts a little mind in gear, you know. It says, see, you reckon these fools to skin them? You know, he got $10, $15 for the others, but he got one, he got $104 for.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got to learn. You know, I've always felt, hope no one takes this wrong, I always felt when I was dealing in that it was almost like a dirty business, you know, because it's you're meeting people on the side of the road, you know, it's almost like you're dealing drugs, even though it's legal. And then when the guys you're buying from, in my experience, especially out of state, you wouldn't ever invite them over to your house for dinner.
Right,
and then you're sitting there trying to figure out how to negotiate with them, and they're trying to knock you down to nothing. And I just always kind of felt, you know, dirty doing it because of the people.
Yeah, it kind of is that way. But I got me a little rule made that they got to come to my house and get them. I don't haul. I don't deliver coyotes. I ain't the coyote delivery business. I'm in the coyote trapping business.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want my coyotes, they have to come get them. And when you get them on your ground, it makes all the difference in the world, boss.
Oh, absolutely.
All the difference in the world when they had to come on your ground. And when you on their ground, you know it. When they on your ground, they know, you know.
That's negotiating 101 right there.
Right. Make them come to your ground. If they want coyotes, they'll come. That's like the movie, you know, Build It and They'll Come.
Mm-hmm.
If you got the coyotes and they know you're going to have some more, they'll come get them. And these folks that think they can set on, well, that's like one over yonder in Swainsboro, Georgia, Fox Pen. They want everybody to haul them to them. I like about my third or fourth trip over there. they said I had a red fox with a broke foot, you know, and I said, you better look at that fox again. And, oh, no, his foot's broke, his foot's broke. I said, ain't that it? I said, so, you better look at him again now. No, I ain't got it, his foot's broke. I said, all right. He paid me. I said, well, let me tell you something, so you take a good look at me. He said, why? I said, because it'll be the last time you ever see me. And that was about 12, 15 years ago. And he ain't seen me since.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a jerk, I write in the office one. I don't deal with you.
Well, part of it, yep. I think trappers need to start looking at what they do as more of a profession when it comes to dealing with a live market or control work or anything instead of a hobby that you do that you make a little money with.
Well, that's the way, well, you know yourself, that's the way the majority of the trappers trap. And I ain't running nobody down. God bless everybody that traps. I mean, you know, because, you know, you don't make no difference what degree you trap, you're a trapper, and I respect you for being a trapper.
Amen to that.
I agree with what you're saying. Is you got to say, hey, man, look, I burnt my gas, I bought my traps, I bought my lure, I bought all my equipment. I burned this high-priced gas getting this game caught up. And now you're going to have to pay me for what I've done and what I've spent, because I'm not going to give it to you. You know, if I'm going to give it away, I just open the pen door, mm-hmm. You know. Let the good Lord give it back to the good Lord. The good Lord give it to you, give it back to him.
Well, if you sell them too cheap, you'll be spending money or basically spending money so they can have the product. And you don't
That's
stay
right.
in business that way.
You're burning $3.40 gas and $3.89 diesel fuel out here trapping these critters. Besides your time and the effort, and you know everybody's time is worth something. I mean, I do, here in the summertime, I do a lot of bat work and squirrel work and just pigeons and whatever comes along, I do it. You know, trim the sweets, I don't care. I go under how and get a dead animal out. Folks say, how you stand that? I said, ain't no problem. I said, I got a respirator I can put on it, cut the odor down to about 10%. Once I get by that crawling rice, I said, it's all good then. I said, I got some good disinfectant I put on that, cost $100 a gallon. I says, kills, knocks the smell right out. I said, the homeowner's happy. I charge a good price. I'm happy. I said, I put the dead animal in a trash bag, haul him off. I says, so, you know, it's all good to me. I said, I pull them old nasty coveralls off and throw them back in the back of the truck and go on down the road.
That'll work. And you're getting into a lot of from our conversation before we started recording. You're doing a lot of the predator control down there for the ranches.
Yeah, I do. Well, we call them plantations out west. They ranches in Georgia. They plantations and but you know, it's just that I do a lot. I did that. I like I said, I've already done two on quail where they releasing them early. Quail, you know, release them, let them get habitized to the climate, climatized and habitized and used to being flushed and being in the wild before they start hunting them, where they'll fly good, act like wild birds. And then I go on these, you know, we got a bunch of folks that's doing this QDM work, quality deer management,
mm-hmm.
And they do camera surveys. And they set up a bunch of cameras over corn, and they estimate how many fawns you raising per doe, you know. And I went on one place that was raising 2.4 fawns for every 10 does.
Oh my.
And in 2 years time I've doubled that, you know. We up to about 5 or 6 per 10 does, you know, already in 2 years. And we keep working on that. And I've done another place in Peach County that I've seen the deer population in 4 years over double. And see six bucks standing in a food plot that go from 130 to 160, you know, and points on the rack, you know. And the fellas tickled to death, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Are you concentrating when you're doing the quail stuff? The reason I'm asking, I've got a client of mine in South Carolina. He's trying to get hooked up with a program that's it's supposedly country famous down in Georgia, where they're taking land and reproducing South Georgia in different states, and it's a wild quail program. And they have if you don't do the trapping the way they tell you to, you can't be in the program. And one of the things is, for nest predators, you got to have a trap for every 100 acres.
Oh, man, I go a lot thicker than that. I have 10 traps, 12 traps for every 100 acres, because I'm targeting fox, coyotes, and bobcats is what I'm actually targeting. But you got to say, I call it trash. You got to set up traps to take care of the trash, to keep traps open, to take care of your predators. So I put out little grizzlies and daggers and to catch coons and possums and even I run some 1.5 traps and kind of get them back in the bushes a little bit, a lot of smelly bait to pull the skunks and the possums to them and try to, pretty well, anything I eat, a quail or a quail egg, I try to remove it from the property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I misspoke. It's one every 10 acres.
Because I was
thinking, you know, for a big plantation to do that, if you've got 30,000 acres or 3,000 or whatever it is, that's a lot of time invested. Either they're going to have to hire someone like you to go do it, or they're going to have someone that works there pretty much full time, because they've got to run these traps almost year round to even be in this program.
Right. Right, they got to maintain. I don't know. I don't remember just what the specs is, but they try to keep the predators down to about whatever they establish the predation at. Say if they can figure they got one coyote per 100 or 150 acres or 200 acres, and one if I go through there and look at the scant and this that and the other and try to figure, and you know that's impossible to do, but they come up with a figure. and they don't know anything about dispersal and all this kind of stuff. Most of these folks that do this, all this planning, are pretty ignorant, really. It's bad to say it, but they got a lot of knowledge, book knowledge, but they don't have the trapping knowledge, I'll call it.
Well,
it's what goes on in the wild. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, grad students and biologists, I guess they gotta find work too, and they're pretty good at making it.
Yeah, but they have, you know, they told us in Georgia for years, we kept telling them that, you know, that these coyotes are eating up these deer farms. These coyotes are eating up these deer farms. And, oh, no, they don't even eat deer. They don't even eat deer. They don't even hunt deer, you know. And all of a sudden, in the last 4 or 5 years, 6 years, GON, Georgia Outdoor News, this is the main magazine that deer hunters and all take in the state of Georgia. You've probably seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they got these darn coyotes, and they got the last issue. You can get your hands on it. It's got a picture. They killed a 4-point buck in front of the camera, one of these trail cameras.
Okay.
He was standing there feeding, and the coyotes come in. They got the deer feeding. The coyotes after him, and the coyotes have got him down in the last picture. 5 coyotes,
yeah,
a 4-point buck.
You know, it's hard to argue with pictures. I've done a lot of work with a QDMA, and that's really become, and it's good for trappers, but it's become the topic of interest at all the QDMA conventions I've been to in about the last 3 years. And
right.
Everybody gets up and talks about it and shows slides and everything like that. But normally there's two schools of thought. You've got guys with money that realize their time spent better somewhere else, and they just hire somebody like me or you. And then you've got guys that look at it and have no respect for the actual trapping and think that, you know, they can read one article or listen to somebody down the road because they called a coyote back in 1982, or use a caller and go out and fix their problem. And they never
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. Well, on that one place that I was telling you about, we've increased the fawn rate from 2.4 to about 6 now. And the QDM guy recommended that we not trap this year.
Really?
And he recommended that we not trap, and the landowner says, not trap. He said, where are you getting that close to carrying capacity? He said, well, listen, we want carrying capacity. He said, on this farm, I think they got 7,000 acres. He says, we plant 230-something acres of food plots on this 7,000 acres. So we can have all this land can hold a deer.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we got bullets to control the population with. And says, we had a coat problem when that man come here, and we still got a coat problem. And says, all pro wildlife will be here till I say he's gone.
Well, that's the way it needs to be. You know, when I'm down in Texas, you've got some places that understand that when you let nature or predators take control of the situation, you have no control over it. So when that coyote kills, if they're losing, and most studies will show between 50 and 70% of the fawns, half of those fawns are bucks. So you're losing that many bucks, potential bucks, every year. And plus, that what a lot of people don't realize is when those bucks have been rutting, you can almost go up to one after he's been after a fight and hit him with a claw hammer and take him to the freezer. Well, coyotes know that. So you're losing big bucks and you're losing fawns at two different times of the year, and the coyotes don't care if it's a 14-pointer or a spike.
That's absolutely right.
You know, and the idea that someone can manage deer for hunting, which is almost exclusively now for antlers, and let nature take care of it, to me is, I mean, that is insanity.
Oh, yeah, you're pretty much right, man. You got to have some kind of predator control. I don't care what kind of game animal you've got out there that you're trying to reproduce. You just got to. There's no way around not controlling the predators on property. I don't care if you're raising pheasants or you're raising deer or blank. Well, look at what the wolves has done to the elk and the moose population. And you got this bunch of nuts that still want to protect the wolves. They'll kill somebody directly and they'll wake up. You know, that's what it takes. I mean, you got to have some kind of devastating incident to get them to open their eyes, you know.
Well, I guess it's frustrating to me because it's even worse when you get in places like Texas where they got, you know, the ranch manager's got his chest all poked out because he's got these deer, and I mean, they're magnificent animals. And he's talking about, you know, I had to use a straw of semen for this that was $6,000 and mixed it with this straw of semen, and after so many generations, now they got $60,000 worth of semen to produce this deer that's going to produce a 250-point rack. And then they show several of these. Well, your brain can add this up in your head. And you know, the does, when they buy them, if they buy them already bred, they're, you know, $3,000-$4,000 a piece, and they're in the, you know, $500,000 worth of deer. But they'll balk at paying someone $5,000-$7,000 to come down there for a month and hammer the coyotes.
Right.
And
right.
It just doesn't. There's no logic to that to me at all.
None whatsoever. And you know, they don't mind. They don't mind spending money as long as it's spending for them.
Mm-hmm.
They look at it through a different set of eyes.
They're really buying
those deer. They're benefiting themselves, and they feel like when they hire us trappers, they're benefiting us and not themselves. That's the only reason that I can put to it. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, for guys that since you've been trapping coyotes for so long, what advice would you have to someone that's either been trapping for a while or getting started in trapping when it comes to actually laying still to coyotes? What are you looking for, and kind of like what are some of the sets you're using, and what has experience over the years taught you about trapping coyotes?
Well, the first thing, Clint, that I'm a little different. You know, I like I say, I've been doing this 30-something years. I set on sign. And a lot of these landowners that hire me to trap, they want the first thing, one of the first questions they'll say, how many traps you gonna set? And I says, well, I'm gonna set however many traps that I find sign for. And they'll say, find sign. I said, you don't deer hunt where there's no trails and no paws or no hook trees. And I says, you don't hunt where there's no deer sign, do you? Oh, no, sir, I find all the sign I can find. I says, case closed. I said, I find all the sign I can find. And I believe it was George. George Good that said that he liked tracks going and a coming.
That's right.
But he'd rather sit on a turd. Now, ain't that what he said?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I am. I love tracks going and a coming. But if I can find droppings, you know, it's kind of like you find a little gold dust when you're finding them tracks. But when you find them droppings, you found a nugget. And you can, if you relate it that way, you know.
See?
And set on sign is the first thing. Set on sign. And I'll set, if there's enough sign there, I'll set 8 or 10 traps. I hardly ever set less than 3. And I use a step down dirt hole. I use a regular dirt hole and maybe a peepo set, you know, or stake down deer hide. But I don't throw the same thing. When you go in an area, I like to, you know, I like to have some diversity. And then after a day or two, you see what's working, you know, and what lure's working, and you kind of transform over to it. You know, get them traps in the ground, get them, I like them about 9 inches back, 2.5 inches to one side or the other, whichever one you prefer, and take a look around you and see how the land lays, you know, we all develop where we like to set a trap, and I like, if there's a little place there, it's a little higher and everything else, I'm going to set on that little piece of raised ground.
Mm-hmm.
Because it takes rain better, and it's just, I don't know, it's just, that's where I'm going to say it, you know. And I don't like them. Everybody says, you know, I think a minimum of 30 feet, probably 75, 100 feet. Everybody's got their own. And it's important how much sign and the way the coyotes are acting and the time of year. It's all different things come into play when you're setting up coyotes.
Now, if I understand what you're saying, since you're setting on sign, you're not keying in on locations, which is what most books, that's about all they show is locations.
Yeah, they show location. You know, they say set up the crossroads and set up the gate cross. I don't care if there's 10 roads coming together. If there ain't no tracks there, I don't set. I'd rather have 30 traps set on sign than I had 100 just set on location.
Agreed.
If you put them traps on sign, they'll catch. If you got them right, if you got them bedded properly, your dirt hole made right, the right kind of lure and bait, and you know, and this is something I'm gonna mention out to Wild Blue. This is getting off the subject a little bit, but and you know, we hear all about the scent. You know, try to keep your scent down. And I agree with that, but let me make this statement. I was watching a show on TV the other night, two or three months ago, and they were training dogs to track people. And they went to a baseball game one afternoon and watched a minor league or high school baseball game, and they picked a person out of the audience, out of the stands, to get scent from. He took a paper towel and rubbed it on his arm and neck, you know, and put it in a Ziploc bag. And they cleaned the stadium that afternoon and night, and they brought the dog in the next morning, and it unzipped that Ziploc bag. He stuck his nose in it and went to the seat the man was sitting in.
Mm.
I mean, it wasn't no problem. He went pretty fast right onto the seat the man was sitting in, right up in the seat and barked. And they was asking, so how in the world can that dog do that? And this was on Georgia Public Television. They said that the average person loses 40,000 dead skin cells per minute off his body. He said that's how that dog could do that. So, fellas, if you set a trap, I don't care if you, unless you put on some kind of suit.
A big body condom.
Inside a bubble to set that trap and don't burst that bubble, that coyote's going to know you were there.
Absolutely.
If a bloodhound can track a man 20 hours old, and they say they track them 4 days old, and if we losing that many skin cells per minute off our body, there is no way you're going to stop that coyote. And his sense of smell is probably 3 to 5 times better than that bloodhound.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Since one of those, I still get a lot of questions about that, because, and I guess it's just ingrained through mythology about coyote trapping or fox trapping. But it's, I had a student one time that came down, drove a long way to be here, and a guy just started, when we first started getting goats here in southeast Tennessee, he put these goats out, and apparently that looked like a happy meal to the coyotes. And within a week, he had no goats left. So someone told him about me, and I went down there, and I set traps out, and the next day the student shows up. And I had the fence set up with snares, and I had 4 traps. It wasn't that big of a pasture. And we had 2 coyotes in traps and 2 ensnares in the fence. First stop of the morning, and at that time I was doing a lot of beaver work. And we killed the coyotes and stuff, and on the last set, you know, I always get the student to make a set to see what he's doing.
Right.
Before I get into the instruction part, because you don't want to mimic in what you've done, because you don't really know then what they're doing. And he gets down, he gets his gear bag, and he's all excited, and we've already got 4 coyotes laying on the ground. And the first thing he does is he smells castor coming off of that trap. Because that trap 2 days ago was on a beaver's foot. And he grabs that and he smells it and he goes, "We can't catch a coyote with this trap. It smells like castor." And I'm like, "Hey, what?" I'm like, "We just took a coyote out of the trap." He goes, "Yeah, that must have just been luck or something, because you can't catch a coyote with a dirty trap." And we bantered back and forth for about 30 minutes till he actually got in his head that you can catch it. And when I was out at Old Gorman's, I watched something that horrified me, because I used to be, when I was starting out, thinking the scent thing had to be such a certain way. Old Gorman caught a possum. And it was 100 degrees out there. And that thing, I mean, not a possum, a porcupine. And that thing had melted down to a greenish goo with quills sticking out of it. And there sat a number 3 bridger underneath that mess. He took the same gloves he's been using all day, and he just moves that pile of gunk off about 2 feet with his arms, scratched the dirt around in the trap a little bit, and remade the set. And I mean, I was horrified, because it stunk to high heaven. At the end of the week, we had a coyote standing in that trap. And that's when all that scent stuff shattered for me. I was like, it doesn't matter. I mean, you don't want to go out and pour gasoline or do something crazy, but it doesn't matter.
Right. The only thing that concerns me about a trap is getting rust on it. If it starts to rust, now I got a phobia about rust. I mean, kind of like you were about the scent. But and sometimes, especially in West Georgia over there, it gets colder. Your folks say, "Yeah, you nuts." It gets colder. It's 4 or 5 degrees colder in West Georgia than it is in Middle Georgia. But anyway, we had to use some antifreeze over there, and you know antifreeze don't rust your trap.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to where I'm over there a long time, and I'm over 45 days or 50 days, something like that. And you know, I can't just run home and change that trap. So I went down, bought my wire brush, and started rusting a little bit. I just knocked rust off of them, put them right back in the ground, you know. Had a wire brush right there in my bucket, you know, and I knocked the rust off it, put it back in the ground, keeping it down. And, you know, I don't have no problem with it, you know. And I carry those traps over there, and I'm still using those traps when I leave, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if the rubber gets messed up in one, I pull it apart, pull the strap off, and put a new rubber on it, put it right back in the ground. And so, you know, dirty trap deal is you know, that's overstated. It's just like the scent, keeping the scent down, you know. There's no way you can. I believe you can ride down a woods road or field road with your arm hanging out the window and the coyote knows you've been there, you know.
Oh, I do too. I mean, I've talked to some deer biologists that talk about how deer, the volume of their smell and the way wind currents work, and of course it got really complicated really quick. But you know, they said, you know, depending on the temperature and which way the wind's blowing, they think a deer can smell a person, you know, a half a mile away. And they don't, when you look at the figures, a coyote smell is like 100 times better than a deer's.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many times, but he's probably got the number one nose in the woods, as I can think of right off the top of my head. He's probably got the number one nose in the woods. Hog's up there pretty good. Old Hog got a heck of a nose on him, too.
Mm-hmm.
But coyote's probably number one, But you know, it's, I don't know, half a mile is a long ways, and I reckon if the wind currents was ideal and the moisture was high and the you know, kind of a misty, light, foggy morning, it's probably possible, you know, that he smelled a human being. But the likelihood of those mornings happening, maybe a half a dozen in 3 or 4 months, you know, during season, you know, without a house, if conditions would be ideal. But, that old coyote, you know, I've seen them come across the field 50, 75 yards to a trap. But 9 times out of 10, or 99 times out of 100, he ain't gonna do that, Clint. Me and you both know it.
Right.
But if you catch conditions right and he picks it up and he likes what he smells, or he's got his curiosity up, he'll travel a good way, because I backpacked him across arid, you know, fresh plowed fields to see where he made his cut, and that's another thing. And folks just starting to trap cow, when you get the opportunity, like up there where y'all get a lot of snow, we hardly ever get snow. But when you got that light snow on the ground and you got a cave cow, man, take the time to backtrack that boy and see how he come in, how he approached the set. They'll teach you more than I can teach you or anybody else can if you'll just pay attention and watch what they do when you get the opportunity to see those tracks. It's just a blessing to you if you'll pay attention to them and watch how they do and how they approach the set.
Well, you're not kidding. Back when I used to trap more at home, and we would get those you know, half inch snows, I'd actually knock off about half the traps I had out. And I would spend, I'd go check the traps I didn't knock off, and I'd spend the rest of the day, and that's exactly what I would do. And it taught me more about coyotes than anything I've ever read.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But we have that opportunity very seldom. I was in South Carolina doing some nuisance work, and we got about 3 or 4 inches up there. The first two traps I pulled up on that morning with that snow on, I had a double caught. And you know, that was my first catch in enough snow to say we had snow, you know. And I got me some good pictures of it. And old Earl, although I was 58 years old, but I was tickled to death to catch them coyotes. You know, I doubled in the snow like that. I mean, probably some of the best pictures I ever got in my eyes, you know. And then I missed a couple because it was stepped down dirt hole, and the hole was full of snow and the trap food, and his foot was above the trap jaws, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, you see, I learned, and those I missed, you know. I watched how they left. I watched, I backtracked them, how they come in, and I soaked up everything I could absorb in this little pea brain of mine while I had that snow to look at and tell me the story that those tracks would tell, you know. I thoroughly enjoyed being there while that snow was on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a buddy of mine from PA that used to trap down in Georgia. And he was talking to him. He said, "Those are the queerest." I never forget he used that word. "Those are the queerest coyotes I've ever been around in my life." And I'm like, "Well, what were they doing?" He said, They were all up, but they would get on high spots and they'd get behind the trap and they'd work it from the sides and they'd do everything but what they were supposed to. And I got so tickled, I'm like, well, is that the first time you've ever trapped in sand? And he goes, yeah. I go, well, they're doing that same thing to you in Pennsylvania. You just don't know it.
You can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see it. And it's amazing. It's amazing at what people can learn. If it hadn't even got traps out, I recommend it. If it comes to snow, you know, just get out and follow the tracks. Find some cave tracks and follow them around for an hour or two and see how they do and how they react to different situations. That'll teach you an awful lot about catching a cave.
That sure will. Well, we better end it here. We're going to run out of time, but I really appreciate you talking to us, and it was very interesting stuff. And I'm sure we'll get you back on here because you're very entertaining.
Well, thank you. If you ever get to Georgia, Grant, come by to see me. I'll treat you so many different ways. You'll have to like one of them.
Okay, sounds like a plan, man.
All right, take care. We'll talk to you later.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I want to take a few minutes of your time and I want to talk about thinking outside of the box. And what I mean by that is I think in my personal trapping and a lot of other guys that I've gave instruction to and things like that, when you start thinking outside of what the standard in the industry is as far as what your procedures are and what you do, it opens up a whole new world. It can be frustrating because sometimes you have train wrecks with it. Sometimes really good things happen with it. And kind of what I want to get you to think about, we're going to cover more of this on different shows because this can get quite technical. But one thing that in the last few years I've been getting really into the best I can, and it's really helped me out on my catch per square mile ratios doing my predator control work, is as I'm constantly, when I'm in the field or I'm looking at a set or I'm looking at a location or a micro location or anything like that, I'm looking for a way to have one set, one piece of labor, whatever you want to call this, that I can catch multiple animals off of. A good example is a bait station. That's not exactly what I'm talking about, but it's a good example to give you. You have a thicket. You put in meat, which is your attractant. You have snares or blind sets in the trails, depending on what state you're in. You can catch multiple animals off of that one set. The set itself is the bait station. And, you know, if you've ever been around any guys that do a lot of bait station work or you've done it yourself, you know that one set, you know, you may produce a coyote tonight. You may go a couple days without anything. Then you go back and you've got three or four coyotes tied up at your one set. This is where I want to challenge you, the trapper, to start thinking outside the box. Why does it have to be regulated to a bait station? It doesn't. You know, it gets a little more complicated when you get out of that specific scenario. But, you know, trapping is learning. To me, learning is fun because it allows me to be a better trapper. And this is, like I said, one of the things I've been into the last couple of years. Ever since the Teachers of the Night video, what really got this started for me was when I kept watching the beaver footage over and over and over again, I started going, you know, that beaver did this and I could catch him while he was doing that. But at the same time, as the other beaver came up in his colony to see what was going on, I could catch that beaver too. And then, you know, if I pick the right type locations, not only can I catch two beaver at one set, and we're going to say the slide would lure up it, is the set, but I've got two traps to catch two different animals off of that one slide. Well, you know, if I can get those two beaver out of the way and the other beaver gets up to the lure, I can catch him in the slide. Now that's three beaver off one set. if I have an attractant more out in the water off to the side, or where if they're coming up on the bank on a different slide and coming down to that, that's what the tracks are showing me and the slides are showing me. Well, heck, now I can set this up where I can catch four beaver off one set. That's kind of what I'm talking about. You know, putting in a conibear in a beaver slide and catching a beaver is great. Going to that same slide and coming up and pulling two, three, four beaver off of one set, I mean, you talking about a rush. I mean, that's woody area right there. I've never caught over four beaver at a set, but I've done three or four times, and I've had a lot of doubles and triples. And let me tell you, when you go up to the side of the bank and you look over there and you got one dead beaver and two live ones looking at you, and you don't have to go 4 feet in between them, I mean, you've got a good day. I mean, it's just something to get all fired up about. And you can reproduce that. You start looking and looking and looking of, instead of setting a set here where I can catch one beaver, what if I use that stump and this woods and that grass and that bank and that slide and that cornfield and stuff like that to catch multiple beaver? What I want to talk a little bit about tonight, though, since we've been talking with Earl about the coyotes, is talk about coyotes. This will work on fox to an extent. I haven't been around enough red fox after watching enough night vision footage. I'm not sure a drag, like I'm getting ready to say, is the best answer, but cable extension and picking locations where when the fox made his first round, he's going to get the cable around either a pole you put out there or a tree or something to keep him out of the set. But with what I've been doing a lot with coyotes is I used to, put one trap, one set. And then after the night vision footage, okay, I'm looking for the small elevation in the back, or they're coming off to the side and they're digging at the hole and they're not acting just right. So I put another trap right there. And when I was staking that, you'd go up and you'd catch a coyote and you'd go, okay, you smart burger, you was coming in on the side, I got you. And then over time, I started using more drags. But to save, because drags, chains, and everything's expensive, you know, that's just a fact of life, I started hooking the two traps together like I still do on my cat trapping. Well, you come up, you catch your coyote, everything's going good. Well, if I can catch multiple beaver off of one slide, why can't I catch multiple coyotes off of one set? So then I started taking, a big showy dirt hole I used my BT-45 steel auger for, and I get the bait so far down in there, he needs an excavator to get it out himself. And I know if one gets caught right there at the set, that's pretty much going to knock that set off. So I'm putting a trap and a drag, say, in a more standard position, you know, 10, 12 inches back, offset a little bit, whatever the ground tells me, and I'm putting that on a drag separately. And then I know if I pick the right locations for the dirt hole off going off the teachers the night footage, well, they always seem to come up on the high side and the back side of that dirt hole, then I can blend in almost like a flat set, a second trap with a second drag, because when a coyote comes up to the set, especially on a drag, When a coyote gets caught, he almost always goes back the direction that he got caught in. It's amazing how this works out over time. When you get to using drags a lot, you can almost tell by looking at the set, okay, it's a cat or it's a coyote. So if the coyote's going to get caught in the trap, going to go backwards, once he gets that drag and trap out of the actual set location, to say he's off 20 or 30 feet tied up making noise and making smell, he's going to be attracting other coyotes. Now, I've still got that set there. The bait and the lure are still down in the hole, except now I've got a live coyote sitting there that's acting as an extra attractant to that area. I still have a live trap at the set. Now, when he blows that trap out of the ground in the drag, there's going to be a crater where my four long spring or three bridge or CDR or whatever it is used to be there. That's almost going to act like a guide, it seems like. Plus, since I'm using the peat moss, it's an unnatural thing then for the coyote to step down into on something like that. But as he works around, I've got another trap, say, on the back side and on the high side a little bit. Now, that coyote can get caught. Now, when he blows back from the set, that's two coyotes that are off of one trap set. I mean, that's one dirt hole that's caught two coyotes. Now, what would you rather do? Make one set, go through the labor of making one set and catch two coyotes? Or go out and try to put two traps at two sets and do double the labor all the time to get the same results? Now, if you start really looking at the set and you start really thinking the way that a coyote is, where he's always trying to sneak up and run around and he takes a lot of pacing back and forth where he works the set, then you start looking at deer trails and four-wheeler trails and the edges of roads and where he may come around this tree and stuff like that, and you start planting blind sets that are really blended in, you may get to have four or five traps around that one dirt hole set, because you're probably going to pick the best location. If you ever notice on your trapping, I guarantee you the first set you put in at a location is usually the one that pays off, because that's the best place. Now, if you're the guy that wants to set two traps at every location, most of the time your second trap doesn't do as good, because you picked it in a place that you wouldn't have put your first set. So it means it's not as good of a location. But if you pick the primo location and you guard that thing like your life depended on it with several traps, they're on drags, they're on cables with locks, or they're on long extension cables where when he gets caught, he's going to get wrapped up in some brush or something away from it. Every coyote you catch, guys, every single one of them is going to be a draw station to that. The other coyotes in that family group are going to know that coyote's caught. And the more noise he makes, and the more chain rattling, and the more urine he's dropping, and the other coyotes are going to be running around trying to figure out what's going on, and you've got this nice stemlet sitting there. I do believe when that happens, the other coyotes get caught a whole lot easier because they're already on edge. It's just like kind of like a football player is a good example. You know, either right before or right after that game, that's not exactly the person you want to run up on and smart off to. His adrenaline's running. He'll get aggressive really quick. He's not going to think about what he's doing. And, you know, it can get ugly really quick because his adrenaline's already going. His nerves are already fried either going in the game or after the game. And I think when coyotes get in that same situation, you're going to have the same thing. So that's kind of what I wanted to bring up a little bit to start thinking about. You can start thinking about this way with otter, coon, muskrats, mink, everything. Because a lot of times, cats run in doubles and triples a lot. If you look at trail cam pictures, there a lot of them are running. Most of the time, when I've seen mink in the wild, when I was doing a lot of canoe, doing beaver control, I almost always saw two mink running at the same time. So if you just catch one mink, that's great, but what about the second mink you didn't catch? If you start looking at your sets different, the approach at the actual set, you know, if he gets all the way into the set, start thinking about things like that. If you're using the cage traps, you know, if you're a tinkerer kind of like me, I've got, believe it or not, tomorrow, Norm Blackwell from N&J Trapping's coming over tomorrow, because I've been playing with a design that I can catch, I believe I can catch a whole family group of raccoons with one cage trap. And he's going to help me build some prototypes and we're going to go test it. So instead of, if I'm doing control work around feeders, I don't have to put out six or eight Alcatraz, or if you're using grizzlies or daggers or whatever it is you're using, or footholds or snares or conibears, it's irrelevant. To me, I'm taking the same principle I used on beaver and I'm using on coyotes. I'm trying to take that same principle to a cage trap where I can catch a whole family group of coon in one single cage trap at one time. Because when that animal gets caught, just like all of the night vision footage showed us on every single type of animal, it gets a lot of interest. And most of the time on the really social type animals like the coon and beaver, all the other family group are right there anyway. So let's go ahead and think about catching them. So think outside of the box. Now you're gonna, if you know, it's real easy, I believe, and I'm not getting on to anybody or anything like that. I think it's real easy to get in a rut when you're trapping. You set one trap, you got one attractant flat set dirt hole, whatever it is, and you go over here, you go on the other side of the road, you go downwind, you whatever your system is, and you just roll on down the road with it. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you start thinking outside the box, I promise you're going to enjoy trapping a whole lot more. You're going to learn more, which make you a better trapper. And then, I guarantee you, everybody here gets fired up when they catch doubles on coyotes. Wait the first time you go up and you catch two or three coyotes off of one single dirt hole. I mean, you're walking 25 foot tall and you're absolute bulletproof. I mean, that is an awesome, awesome feeling. Or you look, if you're a water trapper and you look off the bank and you had one pocket set there and you're catching three or four coons off of it, or if you're playing with cage traps, you catch a whole family group of cage traps, or you're a beaver trapper and you look over and one slide just produced you four beaver. To me, that's when it gets really exciting. That's when you're really going to have to start getting down and dirty with your animal habits and how they react to what you're doing and what they're going to do before they actually get there. So think outside of the box, because when you start getting smarter, things start getting easier, and then that's when you can start going back to working harder and your catch is really going to increase. Now, what I'm getting ready to play is what I think one of the best movie speeches that I've ever heard. I get absolutely fired up every time I hear it. Now, if you've got a small one with you, you know, you may want to listen to this later or have them go out of the room. There's a few words in this that are not children approved, but listen to what it says. And think about it, and really think about this when you're going out and trapping. Inches matter. Details matter in trapping, probably more than what we do in any other thing in our life, are these very small details, these inches that keep adding up. And that's the difference between winning and losing. And I'm going to play this speech in case you've never heard it.
I don't know what to say, really. 3 minutes to the biggest battle of our professional lives all comes down to today. Either we heal as a team or we're going to crumble. Inch by inch, play by play, till we're finished. We're in hell right now, gentlemen. Believe me. And we can stay here, get the shit kicked out of us, or we can fight our way back into the light. We can climb out of hell. 1 inch at a time. Now, I can't do it for you. I'm too old. I look around, I see these young faces, and I think, I made every wrong choice a middle-aged man can make. I pissed away all my money, believe it or not. I chased off anyone who's ever loved me. And lately, I can't even stand the face I see in the mirror. You know, when you get old in life, things get taken from. I mean, that's part of life. But you only learn that when you start losing stuff. You find out life's this game of inches. The margin for error is so small. I mean, one half a step too late or too early, and you don't quite make it. One half second too slow, too fast, you don't quite catch it. The inches we need are everywhere around us. Hell yeah. They're in every break of the game, every minute, every second. On this team, we fight for that inch. On this team, we tear ourselves and everyone else around us to pieces for that inch. Yeah. He claw with our fingernails for that inch. Because we know when we add up all those inches, that's going to make the fucking difference between winning and losing. Between living and dying. I'll tell you this, in any fight, it's the guy who's willing to die who's going to win that itch. And I know if I'm going to have any life anymore, it's because I'm still willing to fight and die for that itch. Because that's what living is. The 6 inches in front of your face.
So if you can listen to that and not get a little bit of excited, not get a little bit more determined about what's going on with you, I don't know if there's any help for you. But it's the end of our show, and I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. Hope it got your brain going a little bit. If you're one of the guys that are farther up north, you know winter's coming, guys. You know it's coming. And from all outlooks of everything all the way down to the Farmer's Almanac, it's going to be a sledgehammer of a winter. So if you've got open water and you've got open ground and you're not in snow already, go out there and get the job done and enjoy what you're doing. And for the rest of us, just because if you live farther south like I do and you keep going south like I do, don't give up with it, because you can get flooded out down here just as bad as you can get snowed out up north. So don't waste your time this time of year. Go out, have a good time, and just become a better trapper than you were last week. And have a good time, guys. We'll see you next week.